Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. So, although Theresa May didn't go to Parliament for a vote to approve military action in Syria, she is now having to do so anyway, thanks to two retrospective votes. Isabel, we had the first of these last night, which was Alison McGovern from Labour's emergency debate. What exactly happened?
Well, there was a vote and the government won it easily. Most Labour MPs had actually gone home by the time, I think it was the SNP, pushed it to a vote. And so that was sort of expected after the debate that followed Theresa May's statement to Parliament in the afternoon, because though there were lots of MPs across the House expressing, well, apart from on the Conservative side, expressing disappointment that the Prime Minister hadn't come to Parliament before authorising the action, even those who were disappointed were saying that they basically supported what Theresa May had done and that they believed that Assad had chemical weapons. And you saw lots of Labour backbenchers, former ministers such as Yvette Cooper, Hilary Benn, saying that they disagreed with the front bench's view that it wasn't yet proven that Assad had used chemical weapons against his own people. And so I think the anxiety that existed in Number 10 over the weekend had probably evaporated by the time the prospect of a vote was actually raised, because it appeared reasonably clear that the government would have won it anyway.
Yes, as Isabel points out, Theresa May's statement yesterday was overall quite well received by the House, but there is a new emergency debate today, one that Jeremy Corbyn has tabled, and in this debate they will be talking about whether Parliament should or should not get to vote on these things. Do you think that's going to be more difficult for the government, because we know Tory MPs have been placed on a free-line whip?
I think Jeremy Corbyn has picked this subject because that's where he's got the most agreement across the House. I personally suspect, famous last words, that Theresa May will win this vote. Tory MPs, almost all of them, are going to rally to her support. The DUP will rally to her support too. And I think there'll be enough Labour MPs who won't want to endorse Jeremy Corbyn's worldview to see her home on this. I always think there is a kind of question here, which is, Jeremy Corbyn's talking about a War Powers Act and what's. I think the War Powers Act would be a very bad idea. Because first of all, as William Hague points out in the Telegraph today, there is a question of, you know, how do you define an All War Powers Act allow latitude for the executive to respond to an attack on the country? But what constitutes an attack on the country? If Russian hackers were to break into the NHS computers and freeze that whole system, do you count that as an attack on the country? Firstly. Secondly, I remember when I lived in the state where they have a War Powers Act. One of the things that happens is that the president goes to Congress early to get war powers authorization, saying, I need this to be taken seriously in the negotiations. So George Bush, before the Iraq war, he went in the autumn of 2002, before the actual war. The war didn't start until spring 2003, because his argument was, I can't go down the UN route unless I can show that I have the option of force in my back pocket. So I think this War Powers Act that Jeremy Corbyn is so keen on might not have quite the effect that he would like it to have.
I think there is a potential way of the Conservatives mitigating the action that Jeremy Corbyn is proposing in terms of a War Powers Act, which is a suggestion that was made by Ken Clark quite early on in the debate following the statement yesterday. He suggested a cross-party commission that would set out what the role of Parliament and what the role of the executive is in these matters. Now, it wouldn't necessarily mean that anything changed at all, actually. It would perhaps make it clearer that the executive does hold this power, and that it is important, as James says, for the executive to have that flexibility that is not allowed by having to recall Parliament or even summon MPs on a sitting day for a debate and a vote. But what it would do, I think, would be to allow those who believe in the principle of executive privilege on this to argue more confidently that this is democratic, as opposed to what Jeremy Corbyn and his allies have been claiming over the weekend, which is this was an anti-democratic move.
Now, the other issue giving the government a headache at the moment relates to the Home Office and Windrush. So we discussed this briefly on the podcast yesterday, and that was when we had the beginnings of a row. It then went from bad to worse. We had a Home Office minister, Caroline Noakes, appear to suggest that individuals had been accidentally deported. And you can hear that here.
So have people been deported as a result of not having the right papers? They've been here and are as British as you and me, and have been here for 50 years.
There have been some horrendous situations, which, as a minister, have appalled me. What I'm determined
that's
to do.
That's a yes. Do you know how many?
No, I don't know the numbers. But what I'm determined to do going forward is say we'll have no more of this.
Then we had Amber Rudd appear in the chamber, where she appeared to blame the Home Office for any problems, but also doubt that claim. And here's Amber Rudd.
I am concerned that the Home Office has become too concerned with policy and strategy and sometimes lose sight of the individual. And this is about individuals. And we have seen the individual stories. And they have been, some of them, terrible to hear. And that is why I have acted. That is why I have put a very clear time limit on the amount of time it will take to correct this. That is why I am so committed to ensuring that there is no cost involved. That is why I'm so committed to making sure that we can work across departments. We hope to be able to get the information that will be needed ourselves, in the same way that we're looking ahead to the EU settled status, where we will be able to engage with other departments to look at national insurance and others. We will share, we will lead on finding the responsibility, finding the evidence, so we can get the documents for the people who need it.
Where exactly are we at with this, James?
So the government say they don't know whether anyone's been accidentally deported. Amber Rudd said that yesterday in the Commons that she was going to ask Commonwealth High Commissioners who are in town for the Commonwealth Summit whether they knew of anyone who'd been wrongly deported by the UK. It is a kind of bizarre situation that makes you wonder about the functioning of the bureaucracy, but the Home Office can deport someone but not have a record of who they have deported. I think the political problem for the government here is that this comes straight back to Theresa May's time at the Home Office, which is this decision to have a hostile environment for illegal immigrants, and no one thinking about what the consequence of that would be for Commonwealth nationals who, under the 1971 Act, were given indefinite leave to remain in the UK, but they weren't sent a letter or a piece of paper saying, you now have indefinite leave to remain. And the problem is that under this hostile environment, they have been asked to prove continuous residency. And I think that is an unreasonable burden of proof. You know, they're not being asked to prove that they were in the UK, you know, 6 years out of 10. They've been asked to prove that every year that they've got to prove that they've been in the UK. And there are just times when people don't have that paper. And also, the different bits of the bureaucracy aren't speaking to each other. You know, Amber Rudd said something yesterday about fixing the problem, which you wonder why on earth that wasn't happening before, which was basically the Home Office would then look at people's national insurance records or other records held by other parts of government to find out whether these people were in the UK continuously. It seems remarkable that the government is placing the onus of proof on these people to prove that they have a right to be here, rather than saying, OK, hang on a second, let me check on the records that we ourselves hold to see whether you have that right.
It also just seems as bad as if, again, the government are on the back foot, but they've almost been pushed into finally doing something about this. Is that the impression you get?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's strange that they appear so surprised by this, because I remember actually 2 years ago sitting in on an MP's constituency surgery. It was in Glasgow, and a chap came in who was from a Commonwealth country, and he'd moved here when he was 4. And he felt as Glaswegian as everyone else who walked in to that surgery that morning. But he'd suddenly been told by the Home Office that he had to go. And the MP said, well, this is unacceptable, and told me that actually the bulk of her time was spent on the phone to the Home Office dealing with cases like this. So this has been a long time coming. And it was really striking, as James says, that Amber Rudd said that she was going to have to ask whether or not people had been deported because she didn't know. And in addition to that, actually, Amber Rudd then blamed the Home Office, saying that it had become too concerned with policy and strategy at the expense of the individual, which is an extraordinary charge for any Home Secretary to make. We're sort of verging on the territory of not fit for purpose of the Blair years. But it's even more extraordinary when you consider that Rudd is implementing and continuing with the policies of her predecessor, one Theresa May.
Now, the other news floating around Westminster today relates to the Resolution Foundation and their research on millennials' property prospects. So it turns out that one in three millennials, they predict, will never own their own home. We do think that three out of three millennials will be able to own an avocado. It's pretty grim stuff, isn't it, Isabel?
It is, and it's something that the Conservatives are very aware of as a political problem, but not necessarily particularly hot on what to do about it at the moment. We have had house building measures announced over the past few years. We've had the lifetime ISA, which allows people to start a lifetime bank account before the age of 40, and they can either use it to buy their first home or to use it for retirement. But actually, the crucial issue of supply still isn't really being addressed.
Yeah, and some of this research, James, suggests that, you know, there'll be a large chunk of this current 20 to 35-year-olds who in their 40s will be renting. This has big implications for the Conservative Party, doesn't it?
Yeah, as you say in your blog, Katie, this is an existential threat to the Tory Party, because if the dream of property ownership dies, so does the prospect of Tory majority governments. Because one of the key things that turns people into Tories is owning their own home. And if people don't end up owning their own home, then you're going to have fewer Tories. That is just a logical thing that follows from this. I think what Isabel is right is you've got to deal with the supply side part of this problem. And some of that is going to involve being prepared to build on the Green Belt in London and the South East, because that is where demand for where people want to live is highest and where there simply isn't enough space unless you are prepared to build on the Green Belt. You saw ahead of, now I can't remember whether it was this year was an autumn budget, wasn't it? Yes. Philip Hammond keeps changing the seasons on us. You saw there that even the prospect of allowing building within a short distance of train stations on the Green Belt, not exactly in a kind of, you know, water meadow, was deemed too controversial by the government. And that, I think, is part of the problem. To carry on the slightly bad gardening metaphors, they've got to be prepared to grasp the nettle on this at some point.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Isabel. And you can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes store. It's called Coffee House Shots. And if you feel so obliged, you can also rate and review it. And we have a special offer for podcast listeners as well. 12 issues for £12, along with a limited edition Moleskine notebook worth a lot of money. Just go to spectator.co.uk/podoffer.